Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the February 16th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main article is Listening to Joe Rogan by David Remick. A critic at large, listening to Joe Rogan, how a gift for shooting the shit turned into an online empire and a political force by David Remick. Trust in American mass media has plummeted. More than 3,000 newspapers have disappeared in the past 2 decades, and many people get their news from social platforms. In this chaotic media multiverse, Rogan has emerged as a figure of singular influence. For a long time, I stayed up through the night listening to tall tellers, UFO spotters, moon landing deniers, holy rollers, and village explainers, the whole barbaric yop of American talk. I could not get enough of it. I was a fairly ordinary kid, Jersey-born, but the house I lived in was shadowed by illness. My mother had been diagnosed with a debilitating neurological disease when she was in her early 30s. Every year she got worse. During the day, I wanted nothing more than to please my mother, do well in school, lighten her load. At night, I wanted only to climb into the shelter of my bed and turn on the radio. I was hungry for elsewhere, for other lies, for what was being said down the street, over the bridge, beyond the horizon. On clear nights, the signal was strong. You could hear the country expressing itself incessantly. Everyone was phoning in, suggesting three-way trades, bitching about the mayor, speaking in tongues, raging, joking, climbing out on a ledge, and threatening to jump. When I wanted a few hours of sleep before school, I tuned in to a ball game on the West Coast. The staticky murmur of the crowd in Anaheim or Chavez Ravine was a sure slide to oblivion. Mostly, though, I wanted nothing to do with sleep. Mostly, I was tuned in midnight to 5:30 to the long John Neppl show. In the so-called golden age of radio, Americans gathered around the hulks of mahogany with bakelite knobs and vacuum tubes and listened to dramas and comedies. Tens of millions of people heard FDR's fireside chats. 70 million listened to Joe Louis clash with Max Schmeling. By the 50s, television had seized the mass audience. Bob Hope migrated to the screen. Radio became a medium for the road and the solitary listener, the long-haul trucker fighting off sleep, the commuter stuck in traffic. Talk proliferated. Gene Shepard spun his Indiana childhood into intoxicating monologues. Political call-in shows flourished. New York's graveyard shift offered everything from cafe liberals to right-wing ranters, with Allison the Nightbird Steele whispering incantations and Bob Fass talking with the garbologist, A.J. Weberman, who rummaged through Bob Dylan's trash bins and found the meaning of the world in his coffee grounds. But Long John was my main thing. A pitchman entertainer, Neville was born in Chicago in 1911 and washed up on the East Coast as an auctioneer. Long John, the gab and gavel man. He sold razor blade sharpeners, miracle pen points, juice extractors, and instructional booklets from the Pelham Health Institute of Sexology that warned against arousing fires in a woman that one could not extinguish. He was peculiar and self-possessed. He rode around the city in a limousine and washed his clothes in the sink. Late in life, he married a former model, Candy Jones, who claimed she had been a victim of the CIA's mind control experiments. She became his co-host. Neville was hypnotic as both a hawker and a covener. His descriptions of the shrimp toast at Ho Ho's Chinese restaurant made me salivate at 2 in the morning. Jackie Gleason or Malcolm X might drift through now and then, but mainly he attracted no-name oddballs and self-proclaimed experts. A farmer from the Ozarks who said he'd been visited by Venusians, an inventor of aura-reading meter and a radio to communicate with fish. A man with a device made of tubes, wires, and umbrella parts, which after 5 hours of discussion on the air, nobody on Neville's panel could explain. In the same way that Chuck Berry led to the Beatles, Long John Neville led to Art Bell. Nebel died in 1978. That year, Bell, a knockaround rock DJ based in Las Vegas, started a late-night call-in show that would take on the name Coast to Coast AM. Bell described his politics as libertarian, but like Nebel, he didn't focus on public affairs, and like Nebel, he was above all an entertainer. He roamed through psychic mysteries and conspiracy theories, UFOs, crop circles, the afterlife, assassinations, the paranormal. His voice was weathered by countless Marlboro lights, but he could carry on all-night discussion about the Hale-Bopp comet and the possibility that it was being trailed by a flying saucer. Area 51 was a recurring obsession. Bell spent hours with a caller who claimed to have made contact with a human race from the constellation Andromeda. While his popularity was at its peak, Bell was living in a Nevada desert town called Pahrump. There, in self-imposed isolation, he worried about invaders. He ringed his property with chain-link fencing and kept a .40-caliber Glock in his desk drawer. Years earlier, Stanley Elkin, a vastly underrated novelist, published his masterpiece, The Dick Gibson Show. He dedicated it to his wife and to Nebel and eight other hosts who devoted their hours on the air to the American unreal. In the novel, Elkin, a comic maximalist, set loose a floating dramatist persona of Gibson's on-air guests, The Range of the Strange. The result is a nightmare portrait of the country, and as it happens, a portent of our own age of the podcast. The catalog includes health food people, eaters of weed and soup of bark, cholesterolists, polyunsaturationists, treasure hunters, a woman who believed she held a valid Spanish land grant to all of downtown San Francisco, the Cassandra's warning of poison in the white bread and cola and barbecued potato chip, conservationist jittery about the disappearing forests and the diminishing water table, and one man who claimed that the tides were a strain on the moon, would-be reformers of a dozen industries and institutions, and a woman so fastidious about the separation of church and state that she would take the vote away from nuns and clergymen, capital punishers, atheists, people who wanted the abortion laws changed, and a man who thought all surgery was a sin and ought to carry the same sentence as any other assault with a knife, housewives spooked by lax food and drug regulations, Maoist Esperantists, American Nazis, Neo-Jagerists, Reichians, juvenile delinquents, Creonist buffs, anti-vivisectionists, witches, wizards, chief rabbis of no less than three of the 12 lost tribes of Israel, and a fellow who claimed he died the same year Columbus discovered America. Long John Nebel and Art Bell are gone, but the tradition they embodied has a prominent inheritor. In the age of diminishing attention spans, the Joe Rogan Experience is freeform, runs around 3 hours, and can feel like the old midnight sprawl reborn online. It's the most popular podcast in the world, and there are roughly 4.5 million podcasts out there. What sets Joe Rogan apart from his precursors, though, isn't just his global reach. Nebel and Bell, despite their high ratings, were marginal performers in a secondary medium. Their political authority was precisely zero. No earnest editorialists ever described them as influential. No campaign strategist thought it advisable to park their presidential candidate on their airwaves for several hours to talk about the possibility of life on Mars. Rogan, by contrast, has become a stop on the national political itinerary. The headline of a recent story in the Wall Street Journal calls him America's most important swing voter. Rogan is 58. A fitness fanatic, he works out constantly and ingests a great many supplements, some of them advertised on his show. He is of unremarkable height, a compact collection of bulges wrapped in tight t-shirts, all biceps, triceps, pecs, and traps, with a shaved head and eyes bugged with curiosity, outrage, or delight. His interviews are anything but predictable. When Barry Weiss was still an editor at the Times opinion section, she was invited to Rogan's studio in Austin, Texas, to promote her book, How to Fight Anti-Semitism. Rogan's style is to jump right in with barely an introduction, and with Weiss he leapt from one lily pad to the next. He did not seem especially concerned with anti-Semitism. Weiss raised Representative Ilhan Omar as bait. Rogan did not bite. She tried flattery, mentioning a recent trip she'd taken to New Hampshire to write about another Rogan guest, Andrew Yang, and the Rogan effect she'd encountered there. Yang was fascinating, she added, though she wasn't sure about his support for universal basic income or his opposition to circumcision. Rogan perked up. Circumcision? He was firmly against cutting baby dicks. Children, he said, die all the time from the procedure. Also, they lose their dicks. And you don't buy any of the studies about how it prevents STDs, she offered gamely. No, I don't, Rogan said. Wash your dick. It was well over an hour before Weiss had the chance to speak about the content of her book. Her host's discursive We've Got All Night manner belongs squarely in the Nebel Bell tradition. Rogan was born in Newark. His father was a cop. His mother was, in his words, a hippie type, a free spirit. He has described himself in an online post as 3/4 Italian, 1/4 Irish. His parents divorced when he was young. His father stayed behind in New Jersey. Rogan and his mother moved first to San Francisco and later to a suburb of Boston. He has not seen his father since the divorce. I don't want to beat his ass, Rogan told a reporter for Rolling Stone. I just don't want to be involved with him, and I don't want to talk to him. He was very nice to me, loved me, but he was super, super violent, and he would have turned me into a fucking psychopath. Rogan's father said his son was making up stories about him. From the start, Rogan was a performer. When he was 7, he was doing magic tricks for tourists on Fisherman's Wharf. His number one fear, he has said, was of being a loser. As a teenager, he found his footing in martial arts. He began with karate, then took up taekwondo with obsessive seriousness, winning tournaments as a lightweight. In time, he added Thai kickboxing and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, in which he eventually earned a black belt. He could kick like a mule. In his early 20s, after years of full contact fighting, Rogan began to suffer from debilitating headaches. Fearing long-term neurological damage, he stepped away from competition. Rogan no longer does interviews for print publications, but through nearly 2,500 podcast episodes and an old interview scattered across the internet, he has supplied a considerable archive of self-reflection. He has said that as a kid he was super ADD, whatever the fuck that means. His curiosity was expansive, but it did not translate into academic success. He was distractible. I wasn't able to take my brain and make it focus on things that sucked, he once said. Why? Because the world was filled with tits, all right? He enrolled briefly and unhappily at the University of Massachusetts, then dropped out. He delivered newspapers, worked stakeouts as an assistant to a private investigator, and began appearing at bars and bachelor parties as a neophyte stand-up comic. On stage, Rogan was known as the Little Ball of Anger. In 1995, he caught a break, landing a role on the NBC sitcom News Radio as Joe Gorelli, a handyman who believed in extraterrestrials and thought the federal judiciary was controlled by a secret society of Freemasons. Rogan's career got another boost in the early 2000s when he was hired by NBC to host Fear Factor, a reality show that asked contestants to eat live insects, lie in vats of snakes, or in its more notorious moments, consume donkey semen and buffalo testicles for cash prizes. The show was a ratings hit and ran for several seasons, giving Rogan a level of financial independence rare among working comedians. At the same time, he became a fixture of Ultimate Fighting Championship broadcasts, providing excitable, technically fluent color commentary that helped translate the sport to a wider audience. What marked Rogan in the comedy world, however, was not the originality of his material. He was a mediocre comedian, but a different kind of nerve. In 2007, video spread online of him at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, confronting a fellow performer, Carlos Mencia, for stealing jokes from other comedians. The Joe Rogan Experience, which began in 2009, was Alarcish's next step in his show business career. The earliest episodes, the Mr. Watson Come Here phase, were ramshackle video live streams. They generally featured other male comedians, and the conversations had the loose, just-talking-shit coherence of a 2 a.m. dorm room discussion convened over a bong and a plate of slowly congealing nachos. The first episode, recorded with the comedian Brian Redban, opens with the two of them fumbling with their equipment on camera. It is Christmas Eve. After nearly 20 minutes of confusion and long silences, Rogan begins riffing crudely about late-night television. The conversation finally gathers momentum, with Rogan doing most of the talking, drifting from the rise of Jimi Hendrix and hallucinogens to ultimate fighting and false flag operations, pausing only to contend with the comments scrolling past in real time. "Man, I can't keep up with these Twitters," Rogan says. After some 2 hours of this, Rogan makes what might be deemed the first political statement of the Joe Rogan Experience. He pulls out a pistol and announces, "I believe in the Second Amendment," adding that it would be advisable not to sell guns to people who are crazy. Not long afterward, Rogan notes that there are up to 379 motherfuckers and thanks them for tuning in and sending questions. "We're going to do this much more often," he says, just as soon as he gets his internet updated. "I was thinking," Redban says, "how gay is this all going to look going back in 50 years? Hard to know. In the early months, Rogan largely steered clear of politics, returning instead to his core obsessions. Space, large animals, supplements of a bewildering variety, sensory deprivation tanks, and martial arts. It became common for Rogan and his almost invariably male guests to smoke weed or cigars while they talked. The tone was part Art Bell, part Opie and Anthony. Rogan's persona is old-school masculine, burly, profane, assertive, but seldom hostile. He is cocky, but not without finesse. He is the jock who skips the reading but says please with a smile when he asks to borrow your notes. A towel snapper, yes, but one who can surprise you. He is as likely to insist on kindness as a virtue as he is to hold forth on the thrill of taking down a deer with a bow and arrow." What was there from the start was Rogan's good humor and guileless curiosity. His habit of letting guests talk on, uninterrupted and unchallenged. His reflexive response to their flights of half-baked knowledge has always been grateful delight. He doesn't interrogate his guests. He rewards them with a cheerful, "Holy shit," or a chill, "That's so crazy, man." He lives in a near-constant state of wonder. "We're 99% fucking chimpanzee. We're really just a complicated form of bacteria." Beneath all this runs a strain of non-religious techno-spirituality. Not long ago, Rogan joined Jesse Michaels on the podcast American Alchemy and provided, without a trace of irony, his vision of the coming singularity, a fusion of hardware and the Son of God. "Jesus was born out of a virgin mother," he said. "What's more virgin than a computer? Artificial intelligence could absolutely return as Jesus. Not just return as Jesus, but return as Jesus with all the powers of Jesus. Like all the magic tricks, all the ability to bring people back from the dead, walk on water, levitation, water into wine." By 2015, Rogan's podcast was a major success, and he happily accepted an invitation to go on the air with one of his heroes. Art Bell was now hosting an internet show called Midnight in the Desert. "Thanks for having me on, sir. It's a huge honor," Rogan began, telling Bell that he used to listen to him while driving home from the comedy store. Rogan was eager to establish their kinship. The two men shared an appetite for science and pseudoscience alike, for mysteries, conspiracies, the paranormal, psychedelics. "I just love the idea of UFOs, even if it's not real," Rogan said. "I love the idea of uncovering some massive mystery." Bell was pleased to hear this. "I'm one of those people who wants to believe there is something more," he said. "Who wouldn't want a UFO to fly right over the White House lawn and everyone to watch it on television?" Rogan replied. It would be a huge, unique bonding experience for mankind if we really were visited. It would snap things into perspective. Bell and Rogan connected further over their fascination with hallucinogens. Rogan volunteered his enthusiasm for dimethylene tryptophan, DMT, the most intense psychedelic known to man, as he calls it. When you take it, you experience something that knows everything. The user comes into the presence of a higher power, gaining contact with a divine entity. Rogan is always eager to catalog what he ingests. Psychedelics, nootropics, extreme diets, game, there is a lot of talk of elk meat, and punishing physical regimes are, for him, components of an ongoing experiment. The body is a laboratory. The mind is something to be unlocked, upgraded, or briefly dissolved altogether. The two takeaways emerged from the hour with Art Bell. The first was that Rogan was disaffected with conventional politics. Asked whether he was interested in bringing politics onto his podcast, Rogan said that he was, but that quite honestly, the game is so rigged. He admired figures like Ross Perot, mavericks who stir things up. What about Donald Trump? Bell asked. Rogan was unimpressed. He's a buffoon, he said, though he granted him a bulldog determination. The second was that Rogan had inherited from Bell a certain understanding of his role. Years later, hosting the comedian and podcaster Theo Von, one of his many imitators, Rogan spoke with explicitly about his admiration for Bell's method. He had a lot of interesting people, but then every now and then he would mix it up with a dude who says he's a werewolf. And Art would never go, "Man, you aren't a werewolf." He would go, "Interesting, tell me more." He let dudes talk. He let dudes say the most ridiculous shit. That has always been Rogan's method, too, letting dudes say the most ridiculous shit. This is harmless fun when Bill Burr is cracking wise about marriage or Mark the Undertaker Calaway is reviewing his career as a pro wrestler. The complications began as the show widened in scope. Rogan branched out early, talking to wellness gurus. Hip-hop artists soon became a regular presence, with guests like B-Real, Immortal Technique, Mixmaster Mike, and Action Bronson. 6 years ago, Kanye West rambled at length about his religious beliefs, his mental health, and his grievances with the music industry without causing much offense. Then, in greater profusion, came big thinkers of various stripes. Jordan Peterson, Steven Pinker, Deborah So, Ben Shapiro. Rogan's own politics are all over the place. He is pro-gay marriage, pro-universal basic income, pro-Second Amendment. He mixes a streak of anti-woke, anti-identity politics, comedy with a hairy-chested variety of broad-mindedness. He was only grudgingly accepting when the subject turned to Caitlyn Jenner. "I'll call her a woman if she wants to be a woman. I'll call her whatever you want. I don't care. But you can't tell me she's beautiful and that, because I disagree, I'm a piece of shit." On one episode, he schooled Candace Owens about her dismissal of climate science. He has found common ground with Bernie Sanders on income inequality, foreign wars, and automated labor, even though they clashed over Elon Musk. In 2020, Rogan said he would probably vote for Sanders for president, calling him insanely consistent his entire life. As Rogan's success grew 5 years ago, he signed a licensing deal with Spotify that was reportedly worth more than $200 million over 3.5 years. He began to attract more serious scrutiny. During and after the pandemic, Rogan emerged as a prominent conveyor of COVID skeptical discussion. He hosted Suzanne Humphreys, a nephrologist who left mainstream practice and became an ardent anti-vaccine activist. She told Rogan that tuberculosis was a side effect of the smallpox vaccine, that the COVID vaccine contained snake genes, and the polio was caused by DDT. Robert Malone, a physician and biochemist, warned Rogan's listeners that COVID vaccines could be likened to Nazi medical experiments. Rogan repeatedly insisted that he was not an anti-vaxxer, but he did not receive a COVID vaccine himself. he refused to accept the authority of the medical establishment. Anthony Fauci, he said recently, was driving me fucking crazy. When he tested positive in 2021, he took, among other things, the antiparasitic drug ivermectin, which is not a treatment that any major health organization would endorse. In 2022, the singer Indiara Simpson shared a video montage of Rogan using the N-word dozens of times on his show over the years. Rogan said that he was not a racist, but issued an apology, calling the incident the most regrettable and shameful matter he had ever had to address publicly. Spotify removed dozens of old episodes from its platform, though Rogan maintained that his use of the word was by way of quotation and reference, not invective. Simpson eventually forgave him. By then, Rogan had already become a broader symbol in the culture wars, and a kind of spokesman for alienated young men. Two leading candidates for the upcoming Republican nomination dismissed the controversies that had briefly surrounded Rogan. Trump urged him to stop apologizing to the fake news and radical left maniacs and lunatics, while Ron DeSantis implored him, "Do not kowtow to the mob. Stand up and tell them to pound sand." Where Rogan runs into trouble is in the extending the same uncritical hospitality to pseudo-scholars and racists that he once did to moon landing skeptics. Over the years, he has hosted a cavalcade of extreme right-wing provocateurs, including Stefan Molyneux, Gavin McInnes, Stephen Crowder, and Milo Yiannopoulos, figures who traffic in white nationalism and conspiratorial grievances. Alex Jones, a particularly malevolent presence, has appeared several times. Spotify later judged some of these episodes so toxic that it quietly memory-holed them from the archive. Rogan was entranced by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who appeared on the show in 2023 and rehearsed his familiar arguments about vaccines while reviving a discredited theory about the deadly 1918 Spanish flu pandemic was not viral in origin, but rather the side effect of an experimental meningitis vaccine tested on soldiers in Kansas. Rogan profits from his influence, but disclaims responsibility for it when pressed. "I talk shit for a living," he said from the stage of a comedy club in Austin. If you're taking vaccine advice from me, is that really my fault? What dumb shit were you about to do when my stupid idea sounded better? You know that dude who made people eat animal dicks on TV? How does he feel about medicine? If you want my advice, don't take my advice." And yet he does not hesitate to dispense it. In 2024, while Kennedy was still running as a third-party candidate, Rogan said that he was the only one that makes sense to me. Trump, evidently miffed, posted, "It will be interesting to see how loudly Joe Rogan gets booed the next time he enters the UFC ring." Rogan quickly retreated. "I'm not the guy to get political information from," he said. After Kennedy dropped out and found a home in the MAGA movement, Trump turned his attention to winning over Rogan. In 2022, Rogan had called Trump an existential threat to democracy, but his friend Dana White, the UFC entrepreneur and a MAGA stalwart, had long encouraged him to invite Trump on the show. 2 weeks before the election, Trump left thousands of supporters languishing at a rally in Traverse City, Michigan, and spent 3 hours with Rogan in his warehouse studio in Austin. It was a love fest. Unimpeded by challenging questions or even mild interruption, Trump launched into one of his digressive weaves, touching on the enemy from within, dead whales, Abraham Lincoln's melancholia, the Hallison days of The Apprentice, and the possibility of ending the income tax. He deftly pandered to Rogan's enthusiasms, from mixed martial arts to the prospect of life on Mars. Rogan even offered Trump an opening to air his favorite grievance about the 2020 election. "How do you think you were robbed? Everybody always cuts you off." He flattered Trump's performance skills. "One of the beautiful things about you is you freeball," Rogan said. "It's stand-up. You have, like, comedic instincts. like when you said to Hillary, you'd be in jail. That's great timing. Judged by the standards of journalism, Rogan whiffed the interview. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. This was not Frost Nixon or Emily Maitlis with Prince Andrew. He regarded his guest with the rapt attention of a beagle pup. He admired Trump as a fellow performer, his comic sense and stamina. No questions beforehand, no prep, didn't pee, sat there for 3 hours, Rogan said recently. He's almost 80. If he was wearing a diaper, respect, but the guy just fucking hung out for 3 hours. On the eve of the election, Rogan endorsed Trump. At the victory party, Trump briefly stepped away from the microphone and gave Dana White the floor to thank a roster of crucial supporters. I want to thank the Nelk boys, Aiden Ross, Theo Vaughn, Bussin' with the Boys, White said, and last but not least, the mighty and powerful Joe Rogan. What followed was a prolonged bout of hand-wringing among Democrats, stunned by Kamala Harris's loss, over why she had never appeared on the Joe Rogan Experience, and why there seemed to be no equivalent figure on the left. In the aftermath of Watergate, trust in the mass media stood at more than 70%. Today, it has fallen to 28%. On average, two American newspapers now close every week. Nearly 3,000 have disappeared in the past two decades. Gen Z and millennials overwhelmingly get their news from TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and other social platforms. And Trump, who both resents the legacy press and senses its weakness, has taken full advantage, denouncing journalists as enemies of the people, filing costly nuisance lawsuits, and manipulating mergers to bend major news organizations to his will. In this chaotic media multiverse, Rogan has emerged as a singular figure. He has more than 14 million followers on Spotify and more than 20 million on YouTube, many of them in the language of contemporary campaigns, low-propensity male voters. Jordan Peterson has called Rogan the most powerful journalist who's ever lived. This is a category error. Rogan is not a journalist. He does no reporting and asks no hard questions. And yet he can no longer pretend to be merely a modern incarnation of Neville or Bell. In 2018, Barry Weiss published an admiring collective portrait in the Times of anti-establishment media figures, including Rogan, under the banner The Intellectual Dark Web. More recently, the conservative writer and editor Sohrab Unmari has proposed a grimmer taxonomy, the barbarian right, to describe what he sees as the increasing toxicity on his side of the ideological spectrum, the rise of a cohort of writers, pseudo-scholars, and shitposters dedicated to reviving some of the darkest tendencies in the history of thought. Rogan has not hesitated to host such provocateurs. The problem is that, when he does so, he doesn't challenge them. He tends to delight in their transgressions. The thrill of saying forbidden things appeals to him as a comedian. But he has neither the preparation nor the disposition to push back. His default posture is the improviser's yes and, not the journalist's okay but. Take Rogan's interview last year with the self-styled independent researcher Ian Carroll and the similarly styled Daryl Cooper. Carroll and Rogan began their conversation batting around, like an old chew toy, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. With no resistance from Rogan, Carroll soon moved on to Jewish billionaires and their get-together on behalf of global Judaism. Jeffrey Epstein, he claimed, was part of a Jewish organization of Jewish people working on behalf of Israel and other groups tied to the CIA, Mossad, and the British intelligence. Israel, Carroll went on, had been founded by Jewish mobsters and the Rothschild banking family. Responding to one of Carroll's arias on Israeli history and early paramilitary groups, Rogan remarked, "What's interesting is you can talk about this now, post-October 7th, post-Gaza." Cooper, for his part, has a popular Substack newsletter called Martyr Made. He is convinced that only the new independent media has both the will and the bravery to uncover corruption. His followers on X have included Vice President J.D. Vance, who has also appeared on Rogan's show. On the subject of the Nazis and the Second World War, Cooper presents himself as an intrepid skeptic, challenging what he calls historical pieties. Hitler, he told Rogan, was a prophet figure who opposed rather than initiated Kristallnacht, the 1938 pogrom. The Führer's anti-Semitism, Cooper argues, was merely a way of expressing solidarity with the impoverished Jewish people and justifying his nationalism. The death of millions of Jews in concentration camps was the result not of a deliberate policy of extermination, Cooper has claimed, but of regrettable logistical failures in the provision of food and supplies. Better to kill them swiftly than to let them slowly starve. Rogan is quick to say that he is not anti-Semitic. After Ilhan Omar remarked that American political support for Israel was all about the Benjamins, Rogan pushed back on the backlash. That's not an anti-Semitic statement, he said, adding, "The idea that Jewish people are not into money is ridiculous. That's like saying Italians aren't into pizza. It's fucking stupid." Cooper's analysis struck Rogan as similarly unobjectable. Why, he wondered, did Jews react so strongly to such claims? You start thinking the way your paranoid Jewish friends think, that everybody's anti-Semitic, and you go, well, now I kind of understand why they think that way, he told Cooper at one point. I kind of understand the overreaction, but it's still an overreaction, and I think what you do is very valuable. Not long after the Carol and Cooper episodes, Rogan invited Dave Smith, a comedian and a scathing critic of Israel, to the studio, along with Douglas Murray, a British neoconservative who is fiercely supportive of Israel and fiercely opposed to immigration from Muslim countries. Smith was defiantly smug. Murray was exceedingly pompous. But Murray, at least, arrived with a clear aim, not only to take on Smith, Carol, and Cooper, but to put Rogan himself on notice. Rogan is rarely challenged on his show, and his mood quickly darkened when Murray asked him why he would invite anti-Semites to expound on his program. I don't think about it that way, Rogan said. I just think I'd like to talk to this person. Murray kept at him. There's some point at which I'm just raising questions. It's not a valid thing, he said. You're not asking questions. You're telling them something. He went on. I feel you've opened the door to quite a lot of people who now have got a big platform, who have been throwing out counter-historical stuff of a very dangerous kind. These guys are not historians. They're not knowledgeable about anything. Rogan was unmoved. He retreated to first principles, defending Smith's prerogative to offer analysis of a history and a religion he scarcely knew. His habit of letting dudes say the most ridiculous shit had hardened into doctrine. Rogan is no less indulgent with the barons of technology. He listened with amused approval as Mark Zuckerberg waxed on eagerly about how corporate culture had been neutered and how he had taken up martial arts to revive his masculine energy. Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel, and most of all Elon Musk have also found a welcoming refuge in Rogan's studio. Last February, while Musk was leading the Doge assault on the federal government, Rogan handed him the microphone for more than 3 hours, allowing him to tout Tesla and SpaceX and to explain how he had purged Twitter of the woke mind virus. Rather than challenge Musk about his bizarre appearance at a Trump rally at Madison Square Garden, Rogan offered only that it was strange Musk had been accused of giving a Nazi salute after making a hand gesture that looked exactly like, well, a Nazi salute. Now I can never point at things diagonally, Musk said. Hopefully people realize I am not a Nazi, he added, explaining that one would have to invade Poland and commit genocide to qualify. The war and genocide is the bad part, he said, not their mannerisms and their dress code. The two men had also lingered with evident fascination on the subject of AI-powered sex robots. Rogan wondered how long it would be before such a machine reached the market. Probably not long, Moss said. Less than 5 years, probably. Really? Rogan asked. Will it be warm? I spent way too many hours this summer and fall listening to Rogan on long walks through the park in the early morning, late at night in bed. In Don DeLeo's Underworld, a character says, I think if you maintain a force in the world that comes into people's sleep, you are exercising a meaningful power. Long John Nebel and Art Bell and so many other radio-era voices toyed with that power. The easing of loneliness, the voice in your ear, was the main thing. Rogan has stumbled into a different kind of power, less magical and less consoling. There is a reason politicians and billionaires now flock to him and regret it when they miss their chance. Rogan is likely to matter politically for the foreseeable future, though anyone assuming he will reliably line up behind Trump has not been listening lately. In fact, he has taken something of a turn against the president. He agreed with a recent guest who said that the president is losing it. War with Venezuela, Rogan said, was a terrible idea. He has expressed alarm at the behavior of ICE agents in Minneapolis, saying, "Are we really going to be the Gestapo? Where's your papers? Is that what we've come to?" He has, however, described the demonstrations there as a coordinated effort to cause chaos. He has called the targeting of ordinary non-criminal migrants horrific and insane. He has criticized the price of the new White House ballroom and recoiled from Trump's post mocking Rob Reiner just hours after he was murdered. There's no justification for what he did that makes any sense in a compassionate society, Rogan said in a conversation with the comedian Shane Gillis. Imagine if Obama tweeted something about someone after they died in this way. That this person was a deranged person that hated Obama. It just shows you how crazy it is, the way Trump thinks and talks. It's just like the guy got sliced up by his kid, you know. Anybody that doesn't see that and go, fuck man, it's so dark. Then there was Rogan's recent conversation with James Tallarico, a Democratic state representative from Texas who's now running for the Senate. The two spent nearly 3 hours circling church-state separation, partisan cynicism, and the possibility of empathy across divides. By the end, Rogan was urging Tallarico to run for president. It was one of those episodes that remind you what the show can be when it is not auditioning for outrage. Rogan is genuinely interested in people, willing to let an earnest guest finish a thought. But he's also a wide-open door, welcoming transgression for its own sake, for stoner giggles. Back in 2018, the Trump strategist Steve Bannon explained to Michael Lewis, "The Democrats don't matter, the real opposition is the media, and the way to deal with them is to flood the zone with shit." Rogan once had the luxury of letting people do some version of that in his presence, the way Art Bell or Long John Nebel did, solving a diffuse hunger for connection with the sprawl of sometimes fantastical talk. For a long time, liberal America had its own soothing and corrective ritual. Jon Stewart behind the desk on The Daily Show, turning in the day's lies and dignities into punchlines. And though his audience is a fraction of Rogan's, he's very much back. But the old circuitry has been rewired. The stakes are no longer flying saucers or pit bulls. Rogan has decided to matter, or anyway, the country has decided that he does. His audience is large enough, and the people who covet it powerful enough, that he is no longer merely a genial impresario of talk. He is part of the machinery by which ideas, good, bad, and grotesque, move from the margins into the mainstream. His signature hospitality can look like decency, but it's the kind of decency that tends to judge indecency mainly by its entertainment value. Near the end of the Gillis conversation, the two laughingly alighted on the fascist Nick Fuentes, who had recently undergone a chummy interview with Tucker Carlson. Rogan jokingly suggested that Fuentes, who says he finds Hitler cool, might win the presidency in a few years. He couldn't have existed before, right? 10-20 years ago, he couldn't have existed. Now, super popular. What's 20 years from now look like, you know? Maybe someone like that can win. Well, we'll see, Gillis said. I gotta pee so bad. We gotta wrap this up. We got that one at the buzzer, Gillis said. I will say this about it. It's fascinating to watch, Rogan said, by way of conclusion. There's like a whole group of people that feel very underrepresented in the world, especially like young men. And here you've got this young guy with a very high verbal IQ, and he also does a lot of shitposting, a lot of talking shit, a lot of trolling, says women shouldn't be allowed to vote. This is wild shit. David Remick has been the editor of The New Yorker since 1998 and a staff writer since 1992. He is the author of 7 books, the most recent is Holding the Note, a collection of his profiles of musicians. Comment: is there a remedy for presidential profiteering? Until now, Trump always seemed unembarrassed to crow about his side hustles. But if the Emirati payment was kept secret, what else might be? By David D. Kirkpatrick. In some ways, Melania, the new documentary about Melania Trump, feels almost avant-garde. It rejects everything we normally associate with the commercial success of a biopic. Narrative, suspense, authenticity, even one unguarded moment. But in another way, it's bracingly honest. President Donald Trump and his wife have made no effort to hide that over dinner at Mar-a-Lago, shortly after the 2024 election, she personally pitched the project to Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, who has vast financial interests in government contracts and antitrust policy. Nor have the Trumps dissembled about Amazon's payment of $40 million for the rights to the film, more than twice as much as the second highest bid, with $28 million reportedly flowing directly to the First Lady. President Trump has been less upfront about a far larger payment, negotiated at about the same time that his wife was pitching Melania, but revealed on its opening weekend from the ruling family of the United Arab Emirates. That payment came through World Liberty Financial, a cryptocurrency business announced by Trump and Steve Witkoff, his friend and now his Middle East envoy, with 5 of their sons and 2 other executives in September 2024. Trump and Witkoff are currently listed as emeritus co-founders. World Liberty billed itself as inspired by chief crypto advocate Donald J. Trump, with a mission to leverage the global reach and recognition of the Trump brand to get internet users into crypto, but its business plan was vague. In October 2024, World Liberty began selling digital tokens that gave owners a right to vote on certain matters about what the company might someday do without conveying any ownership or share in potential profits. Before Trump won the election, the tokens predictably found very few buyers. The company did not yet have a track record, any revenue other than those token sales, or any apparent advantage other than its Trump connection over better established competitors, so determining a fair market value price for it would have been exceedingly difficult. Yet World Liberty has now acknowledged that 4 days before Trump's second inauguration, a company controlled by the UAE's ruling family agreed in secret to pay $500 million for a 49% stake in a nascent venture. According to the Wall Street Journal, which first reported the transaction, internal documents show that the Trump family immediately pocketed about $187 million, the Witkoffs $31 million, and the 2 other executives another $31 million, with a second payment of $250 million expected 6 months later. The journal could not determine how the second payments may have been distributed. In May, between the 2 payments, Trump, overruling objections from his national security advisors about Emirati ties to China, approved a huge sale of cutting-edge AI computer chips to the UAE. A spokesman for the World Liberty said the president and Steve Witkoff had not had any involvement whatsoever since the election, and that the Emirati deal had nothing to do with Trump's decision about the chips. Trump told reporters that he does not know about the investment and that his sons are handling that. It is well documented that Trump and his immediate family have exploited the presidency for personal profit on an unprecedented scale. Last summer, the New Yorker calculated that over the past decade, those profits came to $3.4 billion. 6 months later, at the end of his first year back in office, that tally climbed to more than $4 billion. But the Emirati payment raises novel questions, beginning with the Constitution's prohibition against office holders accepting any present or emolument from a foreign state without congressional consent. In Trump's first term, his lawyers contended that renting hotel rooms at Trump properties to foreign states was not the kind of emolument that the founders had in mind. They argued that this was a fair value exchange and that in any case, Trump donated the profits to the U.S. Treasury. Trump did abstain from new business deals outside the U.S. in his first term. In his second, he has abandoned such scruples. Yet the Trump Organization maintains that it still avoids deals with foreign governments, a claim the Emirati payment appears to vitiate. Will Trump say that it, too, was a fair value exchange and donate the profits? Then there's the secrecy. The sheer brazenness of the Trump family's operations has been in some ways Trump's strongest defense against charges of corruption. Because presidents cannot be expected to jettison all their financial ties, government ethics rules rely mainly on public disclosure to allow voters and their elected representatives to judge whether a president puts personal interests ahead of the public's. And until now, Trump always seemed unembarrassed to crow about his side hustles. But if the Emirati payment was kept secret, what else might be? Both World Liberty and Trump Media and Technology Group, the company behind Truth Social, have brought in hundreds of millions of dollars from unnamed investors over the past year. Neither the companies nor the president have disclosed the sources of that money. In the run-up to the 2020 election, Bob Bauer, who was a lawyer in the Obama White House, and Jack Goldsmith, an assistant attorney general under President George W. Bush, published a book, After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. In it, they offered reforms to curtail the opportunities for the abuse of executive power that Trump's first term had exposed, opportunities that his second term has taken to extremes. To address potential financial conflicts of interest, one proposal would require presidents to certify that they have fully removed themselves from any role in any private businesses in which they own stakes, with no access to information about them that is not also available to the public. A second would force any such business to disclose its assets, liabilities, and other stakeholders, precluding a secret investment by a foreign government. A third would give teeth to the emoluments clause. Any business connected to a president would be required to publicly report any expected payment or benefit from an arm of a foreign state. If Congress did not consent to it within 60 days, a president would be forced to sell off that interest. Such measures are, of course, out of the question as long as Trump has a veto. But most of our current government ethics rules date back to a bipartisan backlash after the Watergate scandal. It is hardly impossible that Trump's self-enrichment at $4 billion and counting might yet trigger a similar wave. David D. Kirkpatrick, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is the author of Into the Hands of Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. Shouts and murmurs, I will be your next president. You're going to love my ability to nod and smile while people awkwardly thank me. White bread, straight ahead, that'll be my slogan, by Bob Odenkirk. Hi, I will be your next president, if you want me to be. I suppose you'd like to hear what my plans are, how I might approach the job. Okay, fair enough, here goes. After walking the dog, I will eat an egg salad sandwich for breakfast, with a pickle, and then some dark chocolate from Trader Joe's. That's it. Every morning, same thing. I don't have time for thinking about this kind of nonsense every day. I've got presidenting to do. Then I'll go to work. I will meet with my cabinet behind closed doors. I'll listen to their suggestions and nod and give a thumbs up and say, okay, sounds like you're working on it. I will not pick the best people, but I will pick the best people I can find who have been working in their fields for at least 25 years. This is my experience rule. You have to have experience in what you are doing. Sorry, that's my rule. After the meeting, I will have a snack, power bar, any kind. They're all basically the same. As I will walk to photo ops and wave to Americans. I will not make any announcements. I will not be answering questions from the press. This will be my favorite part of the day, just meeting people, not arguing with them. You're going to love my ability to nod and smile while people awkwardly thank me. I have learned how to do this in my years as a showbiz personality. White bread straight ahead. That'll be my slogan. Hate on it if you want. I'll be on your side. Anyway, back to how I will do a great job as president. Lunch. Lunch will vary. Either a hamburger, no bun, on lettuce, pizza, thin crust, not a lot of cheese, or tuna salad, bagel. Forget that list, just the bagel, every day. Then I'll hit the golf course. I will have photos taken of me playing golf for 10 minutes. I will not play golf, but there will be plenty of pictures of me playing golf. You all seem to like them a lot more than I like playing golf. Golf doesn't feel like a good use of anyone's time, and I am including professional golfers who, like all of us, will die one day. Now it's me time. YouTube videos. Just let me scroll for 15 minutes. Make that an hour. I can use the bathroom while I do this. You won't know I'm gone, and I'll be multitasking. Might check out the Criterion Collection for a bit. Some old movie that is, frankly, not very well made, but just sturdy and does the trick, feels like a movie. Know what I mean? Doesn't matter. Leave me to this. After that, I will walk to the helicopter and shout answers to questions over the chopper blade noise. This will be exciting, and no one expects clear, concise, profound answers, so I will provide unclear, messy, shallow answers, and mostly say some version of we're working on that very thing right now. I'll mention that I'm in a hurry, salute the Marine, and board the helicopter. Then the press will be excused, and I will exit the helicopter. It never left the ground. Salute the Marine again, and head back to the White House. I will attend to any and all evening events, but only for the first half hour. I'm happy to take pictures, happy to introduce folks, happy to shake hands, and smile and wish everyone well. Then it's an Irish goodbye. Out the back door, home to the home part of the house, and a small bowl of yogurt. Plain, some granola in it, and a bowl of popcorn. Salt and pepper, no butter, no cheese. Bob Odenkirk, an actor and a writer, is the author of the children's poetry book, Zillet and Other Important Rhymes. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.